Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So Boris Johnson has now given a statement to the House of Commons about the latest restrictions to come into line. This is what he had to say.
Mr. Speaker, we will spare no effort in developing vaccines, treatments, new forms of mass testing. But unless we palpably make progress, we should assume that the restrictions I have announced will remain in place for perhaps 6 months. For the time being, this virus is a fact of our lives, and I must tell the House and the country that our fight against it will continue.
Now, James, this is the Prime Minister announcing that these restrictions are going to be with us for the next 6 months, probably. What are the restrictions?
So the restrictions are that pubs and restaurants will have to shut up shop by 10 p.m. Boris Johnson said that office workers who can work from home should work from home, so a kind of reversal of a previous government encouragement to try and get people back into city centres. We're told that the army will backfill for the police to allow the police to enforce these rules more. Higher fines for people who don't wear masks. There'll be stricter rules on where you have to wear a mask in a confined space. So shop workers, for instance, will have to wear one as they serve you. That means they'll be wearing kind of masks for kind of long kind of 12-hour shifts, so spare a thought for them. And in wedding, number of people at a wedding from Monday will go from 30 to 15, although the number at a funeral will stay at 30. And indoor sports will have to abide by the rule of six. So three-a-side football is the maximum you'll be able to play.
Now, Katie, these rules are stricter than some were expecting, but others have been saying it's a victory for those people in government who have been calling for, you know, a bit more liberal approach to it. What do you make of all of this? Is it enough, or are we going to see more changes soon as well?
I think you could see more. I don't think they're ruling that out. I think, though, if you think of all the options that were on the table that were being discussed over the weekend, this is probably one of the least restrictive of the packages that were being considered. So it might not feel unrestricted being told that for 6 months, potentially, restaurants and pubs are going to have to close at 10 p.m, new restrictions on masks, this idea that work from home if you can, if your employer is happy with that, all those things. But actually, if you look at the various things people were pushing for, I think that Tory MPs who are sceptical of lockdown, generally speaking, are probably as happy as they could be, given what was being planned. Now, they'd be a lot happier if none of this was happening, but I think in terms of the discussions and what was being considered, I think that this is being read as a victory for the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, and other cabinet ministers who are often described as hawks. That, you know, on the other side you have Matt Hancock, Michael Gove, doves. One Tory MP remarked to me yesterday, you know, the thing about Michael and Matt is they've never met a rule they didn't like. The idea being they definitely have a reputation for, you know, being the very kind of pro-restrictive measures. And I think that if you look at what actually Boris Johnson has gone for today, it is on the other side of that. I think in terms of what we're going to see in the future, it could definitely get more restrictive. And I think that if you want to understand the rationale of number 10 behind today's announcement, ultimately, they believe from their data, there is quite a regular pattern there, which is people not going along with the guidelines as they were. So part of this is, how do you change behaviour? I think that's why you're seeing, along with the new restrictions, tougher penalties, hearing about the use of the military if you need to, tougher enforcement. That's one way of tackling it. And then the other hand, she had a few tweaks, changes in policy. And the hope is together that will, you know, mean that the rate of infection does not go up in the way that Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty were talking about. If, and I think they would phrase it probably more as, you know, if people don't obey the rules, but if whatever happens, it does not have the effect they expect, I think we are back to a situation of talking about national circuit breaks, you know, a 2 week lockdown, then do we actually believe it's 2 weeks? You know, all, you know, just measures such as, and again, it comes, how do you define a circuit break? How do you define a national lockdown? But situations where potentially pubs and restaurants just close, where, you know, people are much more limited in what they can do. So I think that while lots of people are finding it quite bleak, the fact that Boris Johnson said we effectively just have this for 6 months, it could get bleaker still. Ultimately, I think if we manage to keep it at this, so, you know, you get to December and we haven't had any new restrictions, I think a lot of people in government would be pleasantly surprised.
It's only 8 days ago that the rule of six came into force. And I think this is the point that, you know, these restrictions are being piled up on top of each other. And I think, as Katie's right, you know, Boris Johnson was very, very clear in that statement that if the R doesn't come below one with these methods, then they will do more. If the virus continues to spread rather than decline in the population, they will take more restrictive measures. Now, I think what prevented the more restrictive measures this time round was, frankly, that there was clearly going to be a parliamentary backlash. And that matters because they need to renew these emergency powers at the end of this month. And a kind of sense that, you know, you need to let to see whether the rule of six and these measures together could make a difference. I think the question comes, you know, which is what happens next if these don't? And I mean, that does take you to more restrictions. I thought there was also a point, the 6 months thing was interesting. This was the beginning of more realism from Boris Johnson about what the length of this was going to be. In that press conference when he announced the rule of six, Boris Johnson was very reluctant to kind of cancel Christmas. It was going to, like, oh, this probably will take time. But then what if the vaccine or the moonshot testing program came off, but we could all be back to normal by Christmas? There was none of that leavening of optimism. To my mind, the two big things are, what's compliance with this like? You know, Boris Johnson later in the statement was suggesting that, you know, essentially because Britain was a freedom-loving country, in inverted commas, compliance hadn't been as good here as in some other European countries, and that's why the government was struggling to get on top of the virus. That's obviously one element. And then I think the second question is, you know, can the government get test and trace going to an extent to enable it to get on top of the virus? You know, if you think back to those briefings about, you know, but going South Korean on the virus, the idea was that a successful test and trace system would enable the country to live with the virus much more successfully, to kind of really clamp down on it when it got going in local hotspots and let everyone else get on with their lives normally. Now, you can say that the government has increased testing capacity. It's obviously still not as big as it needs to be. But it's also clear that the kind of contact tracing isn't doing what it needs to do, in part because, you know, we wait until Thursday when supposedly this app will come out, partly because there isn't an app. I think there is one immediate consequence of this, which is city centres, I think, are going to take an absolute hammering out of this, because big firms will say to their staff, go back to working from home. And I mean, that is going to drain people out of the centre of London, Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester, carry on as you wish. And that will have huge knock-ons on the economies in those places. I think there is a question on hospitality, how long it keeps going. I think, you know, it's quite clear as well that this is a real challenge, I think, psychologically. Today is either the last day of summer or the first day of autumn. We're very quick back into these restrictions. And you talk to some people in government and they think that February is going to be the worst month for the virus. So the light at the end of a tunnel is a long way away. And, you know, not to depress people, you know, there's some negative news about the progress of the Oxford vaccine. So I think it is quite clear that there is a long way to go before we are out of these woods. I think that's a psychological challenge to the country, because I think people were kind of prepared to say, okay, 2020, we'll write this year off as a dud and get ready. It's also quite clear that the first quarter of next year is not exactly going to be a rager either.
And I think that is the issue, which is Boris Johnson talking about 6 months, unless, you know, noticeable change. But at this point, why does that mean things suddenly snap back in March? I get the sense more, and obviously so much can change in that period, but we could be heading to more of a scenario that in March say, good news, guys, we've added the toughest part. Now you can hang out in a group of 12 outdoors. Do you know what I mean? So I think there's a question of public patience. And clearly, I think all the polling so far suggests that often actually the people who are, you know, voicing the anti-lockdown arguments are not in the majority at all of public opinion. But I do think over such a long period, I mean, this is going to change the UK economy. It's going to change how we do a lot of things. Is this now a fairly permanent pattern from which we just go back slightly, is what came before, you know, something that is actually feasible the next year or so? Because I also think, just in terms of, I suppose, Tory MPs and how they're responding to all of this, now we know there's a Graham Brady amendment, which is the idea of, with these emergency powers, you would make it so MPs get to vote on each measure. I get a sense from some Tory MPs, speaking of today, that because Number 10 did not take the most extreme option today, they want more time in the House, they want more scrutiny, but they might not feel the need to support that completely yet. But lots of these MPs do say things like, along the lines of, you know, we know we're going to have a really bad autumn and winter. But if Boris Johnson hasn't turned things around by early next year, it'd be in a difficult place. I think that one thing is public patience, public expectation. The other is his own party. I do wonder if, you know, by March, and it is just now slightly changing or slightly improving, if that's the point people are going to really run out of patience. And also, as James touches on, it isn't like these restrictions are going to change over the next few months too, so that could be another trigger point. For now, though, I think partly because things like a national circuit break were floated, there is a sense amongst some Tory MPs that it could be a lot worse what was announced today.
James, what does this mean for the Treasury's position on ending the furlough scheme? You've already had Labour figures, for example, using this as a way to campaign for continuing the furlough scheme or at least continuing more economic support for people. Given that the government is putting in these restrictions again and stricter ones maybe down the line, should the government be thinking about, hold on a second, this is the time to pay people more again?
So I think there is a problem with that logic, which is this, which is some of these businesses are just not going to be viable. You know, if you are basically telling people to work from home again, I think this shift is going to become permanent in lots of places. So if your job is in one of those industries that has grown up to support office workers, you know, for dry cleaners in Canary Wharf, the sandwich shop in the centre of Manchester, all those things, very, very sadly, and through no fault of the people who work in there, those jobs are probably gone and not coming back.
Because but what about hospitality and airlines, stuff that will come back?
Well, I don't know whether airlines will come back. I personally think that airlines are in... No.
I mean, people will fly.
No, sure. Okay, but the big revenue raiser for airlines is corporate travel, right? Us going on... Business travel. Us going on our summer holidays is a very small bit of their business model. Not for the budget carriers, but for the main carriers. That is not coming back. People have got used to doing Zoom and all these other things, right? I don't think people are going to fly from London to New York for a meeting now. I don't think people are... And I think that is going to go. And that, I think, means that we will have fundamentally fewer airlines at the end of this than we did at the beginning of this, because their business models are simply not viable if they can't fill the business class of a flight, because people have just got used to doing these meetings online. And I think that's I don't think that's coming back. I think that the decision not to close hospitality, but merely to say that the licensing laws, basically they need to shut their shop by 10 p.m. is designed to try and stop that industry from dying out too. Let's not underestimate the economic changes that are going to be brought in by the fact that this is coming in again. The fact is, businesses will be thinking, we pay a big expensive rent on this office block in the square mile. Let's get out of that. Let's shift to a pattern where most people work from home and the odd thing comes in. I think back to that Jerry Lyons cover story on the dangers to London. You know, you look at this and you think, I mean, how long? And the government's put all this money into supporting arts venues. I mean, you know, how long until cultural venues are going to be able to reopen? How long until you're going to be able to have, you know, a packed Royal Opera House again? You know, all of these things now seem a very long way off. The fact that you are talking about 6 months, and also the clear implication of a statement is, this is what we're doing now, and we'll probably need to do more later. You know, that obviously does have very profound economic implications.
Now, Katie, in the midst of all this, it's easy to forget that it's actually Labour's virtual conference this week as well. And today, Keir Starmer, the new leader, made his headline speech. What were some of the things that he said in it?
So it's definitely a very values-focused speech from the Labour leader. I don't think it went exactly as he'd planned, given that he chose to give it in Doncaster, but it was to, you know, an empty hall. I think it was in an old museum, and ultimately you're not really allowed anyone there. I think you allowed 12 people in the entire building. So he was speaking not to a crowd. Normally at party conference, you have your whole political community there and your supporters, and you bring everyone together, and it's almost, you know, a rallying moment. I think it's hard to do that in terms of an online message. He also had to change the time, so it went to 9 a.m. in the morning, partly because today's obviously such a big news day on coronavirus. But I think as speeches go, I think it does appear to be a fairly successful speech. It wasn't really one which has had many negative effects. I think probably in terms of the punchy moments, he basically seemed to say that, you know, Labour had deserved to lose the last election, and said that it was wrong. And I think it was interesting because there have been people in Labour who did do this in the aftermath of the result, to blame the electorate or say it's the electorate's problem for not voting Labour, which might feel the statement was obvious, but I think it was quite punchy for him to say that. Talked about national security. He gave some fairly personal attacks on Boris Johnson. He talked about the difference between him and Boris Johnson. Now, we clearly know he is different to Boris Johnson, but he's trying to flesh out what it was. And you can see him pointing to his background to suggest that he was more of a competent, his buzzword, competent and probably a hardworking, more reliable figure, because he was talking about how Boris Johnson had just been, you know, basically cavorting, writing articles about bendy bananas while he had been in the courts of his legal career prosecuting terrorists. And again, trying to bring that national security angle. So I think that was clear from it. Suggesting, you know, while Labour will support new coronavirus measures, they are ultimately all the government's fault for not getting through the virus. So I think it was a fairly effective in terms of trying to pitch him for who he is. I think what is lacking in most things we've heard from Labour so far is they clearly want to have a values focus. That's partly because under Jeremy Corbyn, I think what Labour came to stand for and came quite far away from, obviously, if you think about those red wall voters, what Keir Starmer wants to do is make Labour seem patriotic again, a party that's proud to be British, not embarrassed about being British. Or, you know, might look at previous things and say, well, we should do this now, but overall is a patriotic party. And I think it did succeed in doing that, but we haven't heard much at all in the way of policy. Now, they can kind of get away with that because we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Things are constantly changing. We're not near an election. But I think it is hard to get a true flavour of what the current Labour leader would be like as a prime minister if we're just hearing about values and not about what that means for fiscal policy. We heard about a Labour wealth tax a while ago. Then, and everyone seemed to have different views in the shadow cabinet, and then it just got buried. I think that we need a few things like that, and to know what he's even planning to keep from the leadership campaign to get a true sense of where he sits politically in terms of what type of left-wing leader he is. But I think for now, I think they'll be fairly happy with it, and they are definitely landing the message they want, which is just to try and suggest he is a credible alternative.
Now, James, recently you wrote that the Conservative Party, with all the troubles that it does have, is still leading in the polls, and so MPs, even though they're not necessarily happy with the way things are done on Brexit or COVID or whatever it is, are happy to give the government the benefit of the doubt because the next election is not at risk. But over the weekend, a new poll from YouGov showed that for the first time ever, Labour under Keir Starmer was head-to-head with the Conservatives at 40 points. Has that set the cat among the pigeons in the Conservative Party? Are they worried now?
Not yet, but I think there is inevitably, when Labour go ahead in the polls, as I think they probably will at some point, that will change the mood on the Tory benches. The Tory benches have kind of looked on at a whole series of events and thought, oh, that's going to cost us. And then the polls come out and nothing happens. And so Tory MPs kind of calm down because they don't see the next election being lost. You know, the A-level results debacle was a kind of classic example of that. So when Labour do go ahead, that will change the mood in Westminster. I thought one of the other things I thought about Keir Starmer's speech, which is obviously totally overshadowed through no fault of his own by all this, is the quite clever way that he is trying to triangulate between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. That, you know, if you look in the run-up to the last election, a number of people kind of weren't thrilled by that choice on either side. Keir Starmer is now trying to say, basically, you didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, you now don't like Boris Johnson, I'm your choice down the middle, the alternative here. I also thought it was interesting on COVID, he's trying to frame himself as, you know, look, I support the government in these measures, but the government only need to do these measures because they fail to do other things. You know, he's this competence critique that he is trying to build up. Now, attacking people on competence is never going to set pulses racing. But I think what it shows is that he's got the fact that in British politics, it's far more common for governments to lose elections than oppositions to win them. And I think on the policy point, where I would slightly disagree with KB is that there is so much uncertainty right now about the fiscal outlook, right? You know, what are the Tories going to do to close this gap? You know, are they going to say, oh, you know, actually, it's going to take a long time to balance the day-to-day budget, or are they going to try and close it? And if so, what does that mean? You know, are they really ruling out austerity? Are they going to do it for tax rises? I mean, I think in a way, if I was Keir Starmer, I'd be quite inclined just to sit back and wait. I don't think he needs to take steps to establish his fiscal credibility right now, because the situation is in such flux that he will be better off waiting to see what baseline the Tories are trying to set before responding.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast through all the usual routes. And if you enjoy this podcast, why not join us for Spectator TV on Thursday evening? You can watch that on YouTube live at 6 p.m. or catch up on our YouTube channel as well. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.